Good morning, and may it please the court, Jeffrey Grant on behalf of the appellant Hannah Jones, and with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Proceed.
I think we can all agree that impartiality when it comes to fact-finding and decision-making and resolution of disputes is a touchstone to the fair system of jury trials. Imagine in a week or so, the Seattle Mariners are one game out of the playoffs.
Counsel, we discussed this case as we discuss all cases yesterday afternoon. I have some specific questions.
That would be better. Thank you, Your Honor.
One of the arguments that you have is that when juror number 11, named Cox, not related to me, disclosed that she had answered a question during voir dire mistakenly, that the trial court erred by not questioning her, correct?
Yes, sir.
Does the record show whether you asked the trial court to question her?
It does not.
So you didn't ask?
I don't recall that we did, but the record does not show that we did, and I think we're limited to that.
Okay. My second question is, did you ask to examine the juror at that juncture?
No, sir, I did not.
Okay, so what you're asking here is for this court to reverse a jury verdict based on something that you didn't ask the trial court to do at the time that the matter arose.
I don't think that's entirely an accurate summary of what I understand our position to be, Your Honor.
Well, why isn't it?
I think there are several reasons. First, it's not my job to direct the trial judge what to do, or the role of any judge. The statute, RCW 236.110, specifically says that it is the trial court's duty to conduct the examination, not ours.
Does it specifically say that?
Yes, sir, it does. If I may, it shall be the duty of a judge, it shall be the duty of the judge to excuse. Now, we think that statute makes it clear that if the duty is to be discharged appropriately, the judge has to conduct an investigation.
Notwithstanding the fact that it doesn't say anything about the judge's duty to actually examine the witness.
Well, that statute doesn't say that, but State versus Berniard, which was one of the additional authorities we submitted to this court on Thursday, as well as State versus Jordan, which was cited in the briefing, both provide an extensive record of the trial court going through the exercise of conducting an investigation or an examination.
True, but I think, would you not agree that the manner in which the court discharges its duty is a discretionary determination?
Well, we think here that the failure of the court to do anything is more than discretionary. It's simply a misapplication or misinterpretation of the nature of the duty and how it's to be discharged. We think that is an error of law.
So is it your position that every time there is a report of information related to a juror, that it is the court's duty to decide whether to hold a hearing to inquire further as to that juror, without any request from either party?
I think it is the court's duty to do that. And it's the court's obligation to decide, how am I going to best discharge this duty? The issue was brought before the court in the form of a motion to have the juror excused. And I think that motion triggered the duty of the court to do something. But I think it's also important to bear in mind the second part of the response to Judge Cox's initial question, which is, that's not all that we had. We didn't have a report of a juror who, as it turns out, inaccurately stated how it was that this had come to her attention about defense counsel over a week into the trial. All right?
Well, wasn't the record, because there were declarations put in afterwards in the context of the
yes.
Motion for a new trial also. And looking at all of the evidence related to the disclosure, I think the juror said she did not recognize the defense attorney during voir dire.
She said that.
and that when she did recognize her, she immediately brought it to the attention of the bailiff.
Well, I don't know that she said she immediately brought it to the attention, but what she did say in her declaration is that what made the light bulb go off, which was the same language in the Broughton case,
mm-hmm.
what made the light bulb go off is when her colleague referred to her, in, the other defense lawyer, to her by name as Miss Lauren. And there is only one time that defense counsel Jennifer Lauren was referred to as Miss Lauren before the disclosure, and that was on February 19th, the very first day when she was introduced to the jury. She was not introduced as Miss Lauren or referred to as Miss Lauren at any time in the record before she said she made her disclosure. The other thing I think...
So attorneys weren't introduced before they started voir dire?
They were on the very first day, February the 19th, and she was introduced as Miss Lauren.
And so is it your position that Juror Cox knew then that... that it was her neighbor but didn't disclose for a long time thereafter?
Well, I think our position on that, Your Honor, is that there's really two things. One, I think you have to look at the totality of the circumstances of the disclosure of the juror, and they don't square up as she disclosed them in her declaration. And the second is, I think we have to recognize that part of the test here is that resolution of doubt about juror bias and misconduct is to be resolved in favor of not having that person be on the jury. And that was part of the problem. But the story or the factual record doesn't end there. Later, the juror also disclosed that she knew the name of the son of Miss Lauren. The following week, the juror violated an express order of the court to not speak to the lawyers when she told Miss Lauren that this is real hard or very hard. And then at the end of the trial, but before the alternates were identified and excused, we had renewed our motion. And then by then, the record of what the trial court knew, but we did not, I think it makes it abundantly clear that we had a problem with jury misconduct. And I'd be willing to go over a little bit on this if I could just finish this thought and take it away from the rebuttal time. But by the time we got to, and I think it was March 20th, when the motion to excuse Juror 11 was again raised, as the court had provided, a couple of things had happened since the very first time it had come out. One, there had been what we understood was an offer from the defense that if we got to the end of the trial and we had the luxury of more than 12 jurors, that Juror 11 would be the first alternate. That's not the deal that we then faced on March 20th. We also know by then that the judge knew, but nobody else in the courtroom apparently knew, that Juror Cox had told the bailiff that she was shocked that she could continue to be on this jury, given the fact that she knew the defense lawyer who for over 5 years had lived less than 40 yards from her house.
So is this one of those instances where the attorneys don't know who the alternates are until the very end of the case?
That is correct. So we had 16 jurors, as I recall, 12 with four alternates, and the trial court was quite clear that we were not going to decide the alternates until we got to the end of the presentation of the evidence.
And so that is what happened. And so you asked the court at that point to excuse juror number 11.
That is correct.
For cause.
That is correct, because at that point we had more than enough time. And I think we have to recognize that it was a legitimate concern of the court on the first week of trial, of what was promising to be a 5 or 6 week trial, that potentially we could run out of jurors. The last thing I'd like to say right now about the duty of the court is that this judge in this case exercised that duty of investigation when he questioned what was then juror two about his inability to stay awake during the trial, not without prompting from Ms. Jones' counsel and not without prompting from defense counsel. And so there the judge demonstrated that he was familiar with the idea that in order to exercise his obligation to have a fair trial, part of that was an investigation.
Good morning. My name is Pam Andrews. I represent the and respondent in this appeal. I would like to start with what we have just heard. Judge Eady did address with counsel how to discuss the sleeping juror, what should be done. We had a sidebar, and the decision was he should ask him questions about whether or not he could stay awake. Was he staying out all night? Was he coming in unprepared? So this wasn't a completely unprompted issue. And I come to the court's question.
So why didn't Judge Eady have a conversation with juror number 11?
Well, why he didn't in his own head, I think it's because he didn't need to, and the job he has to do is to determine if he has to take another step. No counsel asked the court to ask questions of that jury or that juror, and I apologize for the misstatement, because at the time we all stood. The judge came out and said one of the jurors has said she recognizes Ms. Lauren, my associate. Ms. Lauren, shocked, said to the court, which one? Everyone kind of chuckled and said, well, it's, and the judge said which one, and she was kind of puzzled. It was very clear there was no recognition by Ms. Lauren of that juror. So what this focus has been on is whether that juror was, there was juror misconduct. Ms. Lauren also would have had an obligation to reveal if she knew this person who she met once 4 years prior when the woman moved into a subdivision on the east side, who is not friends with Ms. Lauren, asked her a question about her fence. That would not even give rise to a strike for cause, which I think is what we do need to look at here. Number one, the judge heard a juror made a mistake, and she does think she recognizes this person as a person who lives in her neighborhood. Number two, the judge didn't think any question needed to be asked, and counsel certainly had the opportunity to say, as I have done innumerable times in a courtroom, I would like to voir dire that juror, or I would like to give questions to the court and have the court do it in a neutral manner, but we would like further question. If you feel it is necessary, no one felt it was necessary. It wasn't necessary, because the question would be, even if she recognized her because of proximity of their homes, is that emotion, is that give rise to striking a juror for cause? And the answer to that is absolutely no. It does not. So we move from the voir dire questions of could she have been stricken for cause, which she could not, to was there juror misconduct, which there was not. So we would go to the questions in the case authority, which is what can you look at? What does not inure in the verdict that you look at for juror misconduct? And there is no conduct that constitutes misconduct. Nothing that the court could consider to say that there was misconduct in this case. So the trial court had the discretion, exercised the discretion. There was no request from counsel to voir dire the juror. So when we get to misconduct, the court then looks at the conduct inside the jury room. What can be considered under CR 59? Did those facts impact the conduct of the jury in? There is no evidence that there was any conduct that impacted the jury. What could impact a jury, and the case authority shows, is very extreme conduct. Bringing something in, bringing in a news article, bringing in some research, going to the accident scene or the incident scene, bringing something in that the jury is then to consider as a factual piece of information. What we have here, very vague statements that, one, the plaintiff's attorneys might be greedy, or that they were a suing machine. The trial court actually addressed this in the motion for new trial and commented, your very first introduction to this jury panel, to the veneer from Mr. Marks, was this is a case where we're going to ask for $33 million. Does anybody have a problem with that? Almost every hand in the entire veneer went up, and he asked multiple questions. Over 90% of the voir dire of that jury veneer was about damages and how people felt about a request for $33 million. Mr. Marks also introduced himself as being from Houston, Texas, not from around here. So he introduced the issue of being out of state. We actually discussed with the court how to address that, and that is in the record. They chose not to address it. The judge said, do you want me to do anything, say anything? They said no.
So I assume that the court asked the general question of whether the potential jurors knew any of the lawyers or any of the potential witnesses.
In fact, he did.
And that juror number 11 did not indicate that she did at that point.
She did not.
And so then what we've heard is, well, the only time there was a reference to the name of your co-counsel, Ms. Lauren, was that first day. So I guess the implication we need to draw is that juror number 11 knew then, even though she just answered she didn't, that she knew then that this was her neighbor, but didn't disclose it for several days.
There's absolutely no basis in fact to come up to support that fanciful theory. None. In fact, what we put forth in our responsive brief, I think, truly is exactly what happened. Ms. Lauren had not spoken to the jury panel. She was sitting at my side during jury selection.
But I'm sure she was introduced.
She was. I believe everyone was introduced. Right. I think I introduced her, actually, to the panelists that I was here with my associate, Ms. Lauren. But I think the interesting thing when you look at the totality of the evidence and the transcript is that the first time Ms. Lauren spoke, and I would say that she has a rather distinctive voice, quite different from mine, perhaps 2-3 octaves higher than mine, but she has a fairly distinctive voice. The first time she spoke in the courtroom in front of the jury, it was then, the very next break, that she said she recognized the juror. Counsel for the plaintiff has submitted a declaration saying, no, we think it was the day before, but there's nothing in the record. But when we put the record together, our conclusion, as we've set forth at page 15 of our responsive brief, is I do believe that she put together the name when she heard the voice. Ms. Lauren certainly didn't recognize her, and I would have counted on Ms. Lauren to have told me, as I told counsel and the court, one of the prospective jurors was a personal friend of my husband, and I'd been to, you know, I knew him. I knew him socially, but not very well. If anyone recognizes someone, they certainly bring it to the court's attention. Now, Ms. Cox brought it to the court's attention. If she was going to keep it hidden and purposefully did that on day one, why in the world would she have waited and then revealed it later? And that's so, the court even commented on that.
Well, and so the disclosure was juror number 11 recognizes Ms. Lauren, but she says it's not going to have any effect on her.
Exactly. She said it will not, does not impact, I can do this fairly. I just thought the court should know. And then she explained in her declaration thereafter, I was surprised because I thought if you knew somebody, you couldn't be on jury duty. But I'm not a lawyer. That's why I was surprised. I thought if I said that, I would get kicked off. But she said it. And the explanation was, I think, she wasn't even positive. She said, I think I know Ms. Lauren from my neighborhood.
So at the end of the trial, when they renew their motion to excuse juror number 11 before the alternate is selected, the argument is by then the judge knows more information that indicates bias. What's your response to that?
There was no information to indicate bias. There was nothing to indicate bias. Proximity in one's house, especially in a large subdivision on the east side where the homes are on acre lots, and the two individuals both say they have never spoken to each other other than 4 years ago, had an interaction over a fence. That is not bias. That does not even support an argument of bias. Bias would have to be if there was a close business relationship. There's express bias and implied bias. It fits neither standard. So if we look to the guidelines for bias, we have actual bias in the mind of the juror, which would render it difficult or impossible for the juror to be fair and impartial in the case. RCW 4.44170. and then there's implied bias, and I realize I'm out of time. Sorry I couldn't finish, but it is in our briefing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, for the accommodation on the time.
Oops, it's 1 minute.
Oh, darn it. Two points. First, the obligation of the trial court is continuing, and I think we have to recognize that is an important consideration in this particular appeal. The beginning and the end of the story with Juror 11 was not February the 28th. As we later learned, and as the record demonstrates, there was a host of factors and pieces of information that the trial court was aware of, many of which were not shared with the rest of us and would have had an opportunity to examine Juror 11. The second thing is, how did Ms. Lawrence, how did the juror become aware of this? Her declaration, clerk's page 487, says Ms. Andrews verbally referred to her co-counsel as Ms. Lauren. A light bulb went off. It was not when I heard her speak or when I saw her stand up. And, oh, by the way, Ms. Lauren, during the voir dire, was assisting in the passing of the microphone to the jurors. I mean, she was visible, introduced, and known. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just an administrative matter. Mr. Bellette asked to be admitted pro hac vice. Is that still a motion that is before us? Because we ruled on it last Friday.
Yes, sir. It is before you.
Okay.
I believe, but
I expected to see him here this morning. That's why I asked.
Yes, sir. And he's not. And so I'm
good. I'm glad you cleared
it. But we granted the motion.
We granted the motion.
Well, he's not here because it was uncertain. Let me be clear about that.
Okay.
Because we had assumed he would be. He was admitted in the trial court, and it obviously played a significant role during the trial. We'd assumed that he was, but I think the decision was made that the suing machine could stay in Texas, and they would let me handle the argument this morning.
Okay. Thank you very much for the clarification.
We're at recess.
And thank you for the word, Your Honor.